In the first hour of the program today, we will be spending some time talking about politics in India and also certainly about the relationship between India and the United States. And we have as our guest this morning a gentleman who's been both involved in journalism in India and also in politics. Kewal Ram Malkani is our guest. He's visiting the campus of the University of Illinois and was good enough to come and spend some time with us. He has had a long career as a journalist. He was sub-editor of the National Indian Daily Hindustan Times. That was in 1948, and subsequently was editor of the Weekly Organizer. Back in the early 60s, he was a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. He's also served as vice president of the BJP, which is the currently ruling party in India. He was vice president of the BJP from 1990 until 1994. He also served as a member of the Indian Senate, the upper house of parliament, from 1994 until 1999, and currently continues to be very much involved as a party strategist for the BJP. As we talk, you certainly should feel free to be a part of the conversations. Questions are welcome, and I know he will do his best to respond. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILO. Those are the numbers. Thank you very much for being here. We appreciate it. President Clinton was in the region back in March, and at the time when he visited India, he was the, if I remember this all right, he was the first American president to visit India in 20 years. He went to Pakistan. It had been 30 years since an American president had been there, and he visited Bangladesh, and no American president has ever been there. And I think that that people who live in this region feel that they would like India, Pakistan, the West and South Asia to have a more important place on the American agenda. And it seems that the United States, well, during the Cold War, wasn't really quite sure what sort of relationship it wanted with India. And now that the Cold War's over, it still doesn't know. Can you talk a little bit about, from the Indian perspective, what sort of relationship Indians would like to have with the United States?
We'd like to have the friendliest of relations with the USA. Our feeling is that since the early 50s, because of the military alliance with Pakistan, USA has been neutral on the side of Pakistan. This has been our feeling. Mm. But with the end of the Cold War, I think things have started changing. And the recent visit of President Clinton to India, I think, has made a qualitative change to the situation. And we expect that relations will become friendlier and friendlier.
Mm. What sort of obstacles do you see, aside from what has been a long-standing relationship between the United States and Pakistan? What else is getting in the way?
Occasional pressures on economic issues. For example, the pressure to open our insurance sector to foreign companies. Now, if we thought it was in our interest and we opened it on our own, that would be okay. But there has been a continuous pressure. Open this, open that, reduce the custom duties, which may not always be good for the Indian industry. I have a feeling that we have opened up the economy too much, too fast, and as a result, many industries have closed down. I'll give you just one example. Steel Authority of India used a profit of something like 15,000 crore rupees 2 years back. Today it is lost to the same extent. And even the Prime Minister admitted in the upper house that the employment situation is appalling. So I think there has been precipitate opening up of the Indian economy.
Hmm. How much of a problem in this relationship is the disapproval of the United States of India's decision to test nuclear weapons?
I don't think that has been particularly pardoned.
So that's not really. It may be a problem, but not a big problem.
Not much of a problem, no.
Is it seems that in American policy circles, in many people's minds, that is the number one issue. But you don't see that as being more serious than anything else?
No, not really. Sanctions were applied. They didn't hurt us hardly at all. It didn't affect us in any way in particular. Mm. See, this is a huge country with a continental economy, and the sanctions by America don't mean much. Such sanctions can hurt America as much as India. So I think some of them have been lifted. Maybe the rest will be lifted before long. Not much of a problem as I see it.
I think for a long time before the first test occurred in 98, people who studied nuclear proliferation believed that both India and Pakistan had the capability to build nuclear weapons if they chose, and that for a long time they chose not to. The BJP came to power apparently feeling that this was something that it was important for India to not only to have the capability but to demonstrate the capability, and which led then some people to be very concerned about the possibility for conflict in the region, particularly between those two countries. Why did the BJP feel that it was so important to build and test these nuclear weapons?
First nuclear testing in India took place almost a quarter century back, 1974. After that, repeatedly, government of India tried to go in for a second test, and I understand that there was pressure not to do it. And the government yielded. This time, the new government did not yield and went in for it. Reasons were many. Number one, the West always thought that India was denying it, but it had some nuclear bombs tucked away somewhere in the corner. We were getting the worst of both worlds. We didn't have the bomb, and we were accused of having one. Secondly, nuclear science, missile technology, these are the frontiers of science and technology. We don't want to be left behind. And there are security considerations. We have had two wars, unfortunately, with Pakistan. We had one war with China. In this situation, China has become a definite nuclear power, and we knew that Pakistan could any day go nuclear. In this situation, we thought it necessary to have a few nuclear bombs with us.
Mm-hmm. I know that there are people who in government who continue to feel that this was the right decision and that India's security has been enhanced. By the same token, I'm not sure about how people in India feel this, but people who study this part of the world feel the opposite. And in fact, that somehow this has made – certainly has made the relationship between India and Pakistan more difficult, and it is now probably as bad as it's been at least since you fought the war that you mentioned in 1971. Do you think – are there people now who believe that this might have been a miscalculation?
I don't think so. There has been no opposition to the nuclear program in India. Nobody, not even by the opposition parties, nobody.
Where do you think the program is headed? One recent story that I looked at suggested that at the point where India demonstrates its capability to build and detonate a hydrogen bomb, that at that point then the government might be willing to say, all right, that's enough, we've demonstrated this, and would even consider signing the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. How far does this program go?
You know, this is for the military people, the scientists, and the government to decide. We should have minimum credible deterrent.
Just what sort of threat do you think that China poses to India?
The fact that it is there, the fact it's trying to reach out to the Indian Ocean. It has very close relations with Burma. It's trying to develop very close relations with Sri Lanka. And we have had a nasty war with China. Mm. Very unfortunate.
Are there still unresolved border issues between the two countries?
They are unresolved. Mm.
Just recently, the president of India was in China and gave a speech saying that he thought that the two countries should work on improving their relations. Very diplomatic thing to say, I guess. What prospect do you think there are, in fact, for that relationship to get better?
I would put it this way. There's less tension between India and China today than there was 5 years earlier or 10 years earlier. I hope tensions will further reduce, and maybe there'll be growth in trade. But the good issue is Tibet. We in India have a feeling that, I'm sorry to say this, that Mr. Nehru was wrong in conceding Chinese suzerainty over Tibet. Tibet is a huge mass of land, very different from China, as also from India. But as anything, it has closer links with India than with China. So I think that was a very bad mistake on the part of the then government of India, who were new to, we had no experience in the exercise of sovereignty, and we lightly conceded Chinese claim. We should not have done so.
Well, I want to be clear that I understand here. Are you arguing that Tibet should be independent, or are you saying that
the ideal thing would be that Tibet should be independent. It deserves to be independent. Uh-huh. It's a culture of its own, language of its own, history of its own.
But you also feel that Tibet falls within the Indian sphere of influence.
Let it be independent. I know culturally it's closer to India because of Buddhism. But we need not emphasize that too much. Let it be an independent buffer between India and Pakistan. It's not a small buffer. It's a huge land of territory. Very, very different, with very distinct culture, language, literature, everything. They deserve to be free.
Is there, do you think, competition between India and China for being the leading power in the region? Is that part of the difficulty?
I don't think so. See, Asia is a huge continent. Perhaps with half the world population is there in Asia. And the sphere of influence of India should extend roughly from Aden on the one side to Singapore on the other. And as far as Far East is concerned, China is obviously the first power.
I should introduce again our guest for this morning. We're talking with Kewal Ram Malkani. He was the vice president for a number of years between 1990 and 94 of the ruling party in India, the BJP. He also served in the Indian Parliament from 1994 until 1999 and continues to be very much involved in Indian politics. He also was a journalist for many years, working for a couple of different Indian papers, and is visiting the campus and was good enough to come over and spend a little time talking with us about India and Indian politics. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455 or WILL. There, it's probably a great understatement to talk about the difficulty in the relationship between India and Pakistan. And as I said, that it's, for a number of reasons, it's probably, tensions are probably greater now than they have been in at least, well, I don't know, maybe in about 20, 30 years. For a number of reasons. The nuclear issue is one, the coup in Pakistan, another, conflict over Kashmir, another. Back at the point when Nawaz Sharif was still Prime Minister of Pakistan before the coup, he met with Mr. Vajpayee, and there looked like there were the beginnings of some rapprochement between the two countries. And then some other things happened, and that stopped. What possibility do you see for things getting back on track for some talks between the two countries?
I think Pakistan has to have a democratic system.
So at the very least, you would say the military should not be running the country. There should be elections, and that's the point to start, and then you proceed from there.
Yes, certainly. Why not? Yeah.
So there can be no talks between the two governments now.
There'll be no serious talks. There might be contacts at lower levels, but no serious talks. I don't visualize them.
It from what I read, it seems that there are no contacts. Not only are the two governments not talking to one another, but even at lower levels, there are no contacts. There had been, over time, a variety of contacts on various levels, and even more informal kinds of contacts have for the moment, have ended?
Well, we have ambassadors in the two countries. That's contact enough.
Hmm. Is there some role that the United States can play here in mediating this relationship?
I think USA can play a very, very positive role in this. Persuading Pakistan to see reason, to restore democracy in the land, and be realistic and accept the situation, the border between India and Pakistan and Kashmir.
Hmm.
The line of control should be recognized as final.
And that Kashmir should continue to be part of India?
Well, Kashmir stands divided. We keep what we have. We got it legally. They occupied it forcibly, but government of India might be willing to concede the situation on the other side.
Hmm. We have a couple of callers and would be happy to hear from others. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. We'll start out with a caller in Peoria, line number 4.
Yes, good morning.
Yes.
Do you know that Caterpillar Tractor Company has several hundred Indians in the computer division here in Peoria?
Of course we do.
Sir?
Yes, I think the guest is acknowledging the fact that he does know that.
Yes. We have two adopted grandchildren from India. One is from South India and the other is from North India. They're excellent students. One is going to go through college this year. Why is it that the young people are leaving India?
They leave India, they come back to India. They come here for better prospects, for more education, more educational opportunities. People are coming to USA from all over the world, from China, from Japan, from UK, from everywhere. So it's no wonder. It's a magnet.
Thank you.
I think when one talks about the possibility of greater economic relationship between India and the United States. One of the things one has to acknowledge at India is not only is it a large country and maybe the world's largest democracy, but it also may have the world's largest middle class. Does India find it difficult to try to provide opportunities for those people? I mean, are people forced to go to the United States or go elsewhere in the world because the Indian economy simply can't absorb their talents?
We have so much talent that you can easily afford to export some.
Mm.
We have a very bright middle class. People go out of their way, do anything to have their children educated. They'll incur debts and get their children educated. So we have a lot of talent in the country.
Mm. Is there... people know or perhaps know that high-tech, particularly software, has become a very important part of the Indian economy, and that has become a very important export for India. Is there any sense that that sector of the economy has been stressed at the expense of perhaps some others? Or is it just that this is the thing that we hear about and it's not...
I don't think so.
Yeah.
As I said, we have talent enough in all fields.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk with another caller. We'll go to Urbana, line number 1.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. You spoke about a precondition or a basic desirability that Pakistan becomes a democracy in order to begin improving relationships. And Pakistan did have democratically elected governments before this one, and yet things did not improve even on a humanitarian level. I'm particularly thinking about the issue that Asma Jahangir recently brought out into the public on her visit to India, saying that at least 50 or more Indian POWs from 1971 and 1965 still may be in Pakistani jails. Another news said that the list could be as high as 1,600. Is there any chance that progress could be made on this issue? Are there any signs from the Pakistani side that they would be willing to consider a beginning on this basis now that 30 years have passed, or 35 in one case? I would like to hear your views on this. Thank you.
There was one recent case of an Indian being returned from Pakistan. If there are any more, I hope they are returned. And if there are any POWs detained on the Indian side, I hope we also return them. There should be frankness on both sides.
So you say this remains an open question of whether indeed there are on either side?
Nobody admits. No side admits. It's possible that there are some on both sides.
You did, as the caller pointed out, you were talking about the fact that at this point you don't see the possibility of talks between India and Pakistan as long as Pakistan continues to be under military rule. But as the caller said, you know, things weren't necessarily all that better when there was a democratic government.
They were very much better.
They were.
The two prime ministers met.
They met.
And there was a public, great big public reception for the Indian prime minister. And I'm sure within months, the Pakistan prime minister would also have visited India, and things would have improved further still. I think there are interests, wasted interests, which do not want Indo-Pakistan relations to improve.
Western interests.
Wasted interests.
Vested
interests.
So you're thinking perhaps of, shall we say, the Pakistani military?
One is that. Secondly is the bureaucracy. You see, in a united India, before 47, India was one state. There would be one head of state, one head of government, one parliament, one Supreme Court. Today, the whole thing has been trebled. There are three governments, three armies, three chiefs of staff, and all these services, civil and military, have a vested interest in continued tensions and partition.
It has been suggested that it is the man who now is heading the government in Pakistan, General Musharraf, who was responsible for the move of Pakistani troops into Kashmir last summer that started the latest round of fighting there. Do you think, or are there people who believe that this was a deliberate action undertaken by the military in Pakistan who didn't want to see improved relationship between Pakistan and India?
I think so.
And by the same token, there are Indians who also don't want to see improved relationship between the two countries?
I don't know of any such Indians.
You don't know of any?
Any. Who would like relations to improve. Who would like to live in peace and amity. You see, there was a time when there was tension between, let us say, USA and Canada. For the last 100 years, they have been living in peace. We should have similar relations between India and Pakistan. You see, Pakistan should not try to compete with India. It cannot, because India is 6 or 8 times the size of Pakistan. Area-wise, population-wise, industry-wise, this is impossible. Even USSR could not compete with USA. So how does Pakistan compete with India? It can only fail. It will go bankrupt. I'm sorry to say this. Being an old Pakistani, I was born in the Pakistan area. I have a certain empathy with the people in Pakistan. I think they are on a very wrong course.
From what I read, again, a commentary about politics of the region, some people suggest that the difficulty with getting the two sides to talk is that each side is expecting the other side to go first, in a sense that, you know, India wants Pakistan to make concessions. Pakistan wants India to make concessions. And the only way that this is going to go forward is if both sides agree to somehow make parallel sorts of moves so that each side can say, yes, we're doing something, but you're doing something. But that to date, it's been too much the case that each side wants the other side to go first, essentially.
No side need make concessions to the other side. We just keep whatever issues are there in deep freeze, 5 years, 10 years. And meanwhile, liberalize the economies, have more and more trade, if not complete free trade, We should move in that direction. Today, the situation is that we in India cannot get Pakistani papers and books. People in Pakistan do not know what is happening in India, except from what they hear from the radio or the TV. So there should be a free movement of books, magazines, newspapers. I think that would be one good, big way in bringing people together. And there should be a freer issue of visas. Now, we had a visa consulate in Karachi and it has been closed down. And lots of people in Pakistan want to visit India. I'm sure lots of people in India want to visit Pakistan. We should encourage these. Artists, scientists, journalists, they should be free to move out. Pakistan doesn't seem to be interested in that kind of people-to-people contact.
Hmm. Why do you think that is?
I think they have a fear. If more and more people cross the border and go to the other side, they'll find that we are basically one people. Both of us speak the same set of languages. And that might weaken the Red Cliff line, the partition line between India and Pakistan. I think people, in, at least the establishment in Pakistan, is afraid of that situation.
That they would like to continue to have people of Pakistan think of India as being an aggressive neighbor rather than peaceful neighbor.
Absolutely.
And you think that if those, if economic exchanges, cultural exchanges, those sorts of things started and could continue for some point, then that would make it easier sometime in the future to resolve political difficulties like Kashmir. That seems to be the number one problem. Or are there others that we in the West perhaps don't hear that much about?
Kashmir is a major problem, but it is not the core problem. The core problem is the antipathy between two states, between two societies. The hate propaganda that went on with the movement for partition, this is at the root of it. To this day, history books in Pakistan give a very wrong impression about India, Indian society, Hindu religion, etc. Actually, our friend referred to Asma Jahangir. I made this point when we met last month in Delhi, and I said that Kashmir is a major issue, but not the core issue. Core issue is this hatred which is happening. Mm-hmm. And she entirely agreed. Mm-hmm. And she said that even if Kashmir issue is solved, vested interests will rake up some other issue to continue the quarrel. I even suggested that we should exchange our history books, particularly history books. Let them have a look at Indian history books. We can have a look at Pakistan history books. If there's something wrong, something that is not objective, something that's not fair, we can have it corrected. The two sides have to behave as gentlemen, in this respect.
Mm. Well, you talked about the fact that that both people in India and Pakistan really should remember, should appreciate just how much they have in common. What, aside from perhaps religious differences, since Pakistan is Muslim predominantly and India is Hindu predominantly, what other sorts of differences are there?
There's none.
That's really it? The religious thing is the major difference?
What is there, but there are no other differences. You know, the same racial mix on both sides, whether you call it Aryan or Dravidian or Scythian or whatever, you will get, let us say, the community of Jats. You have Hindu Jats, you have Muslim Jats, you have Sikh Jats, and so on with Thakurs, and with every caste, with every community. So apart from this religious difference, there's no difference between the peoples.
Hmm. So it goes back to people in power interested in staying in power and having as large a sphere of influence as they possibly can have?
Quite.
Right. Here is a caller in Champaign to talk with Line 1. Hello.
You just answered my question, and that religion, I think, is the transcendent issue that divides the people of Pakistan and India, not Kashmir. I just think Kashmir is a geographical problem. If you've ever been there, Kashmir, who wants to live in Kashmir? It's basically barren and desolate. I think if you go back to when India was British India, and I think how the British, during their colonial period of about 300 years, pitted Hindu against the Muslims, and when it was divided or became independent, Pakistan and India, how many Hindus were killed trying to get from Pakistan to India, and how many Muslims were killed from trying to get from India to Pakistan. I mean, this problem of religious intolerance is really that serious, deep problem that will forever haunt relations between Pakistan and India. And unless they can come to grips with that, just like we perhaps can never come to grips with the problem of black and white racism in this country, they have serious problems. And unless they can talk about that honestly and deal with it honestly, they will always be a potential powder keg in world geopolitical politics. Thanks.
All right. Well, you want to comment on what the caller had to say?
You're right, sir. The only thing that divides Indians and Pakistanis is this religious intolerance. And I'm afraid this religious intolerance is hurting Pakistan also, because there are many religious sects among the Muslim community. There are the Sunnis, the Shias, the Ahmadiyyas, and I'm sure there are many more. So there's been a lot of fighting between these groups themselves. And but I also think that the things that divide Indians from Pakistanis are not a fraction as serious as those that divide from the blacks in America. In India and Pakistan, we are basically one people divided only by religion, religious persuasion. That is, those who are particularly religious, nothing beyond that. For the race, we are the same racial stock, the same culture, same festivals. I was pleasantly surprised in Pakistan to see Basant celebrated. Sometime back, the Students' Union of Punjab decided that the national festival of Punjab was Vaisakhi, which is an old, ancient, traditional Indian festival. So culturally also, there's not much to divide the two countries. It's basically only the religious creed that divides us.
Just for a moment, going back to Kashmir, it's one of the complications I gather is that not all Kashmiris are of one mind about what the future of the country should be. There are people who would like Kashmir to be independent. There are some people who would like to continue to be allied with India. There are some people who would like to be allied with Pakistan. It seems that there are parties that are pulling all in different directions. Do you think that what we're really talking about here over the long-term solution does amount to a kind of a partition of the area and say, all right, part of this is part of it's going to be Indian, part of it's going to be Pakistan, and I don't know what else, because there do continue to be people there who want it to be an independent state.
You're right about it, but neither India nor Pakistan will agree to independent Kashmir. Let us remember one thing. This is a huge state, Jammu, Kashmir, and Ladakh state. Jammu is predominantly Hindu. Ladakh is predominantly Buddhist. The only dispute is about the Kashmir Valley. And I think the total area of Kashmir is about 600 square miles. This is all that is there. I think it would be reasonable for both India and Pakistan to accept the situation on the ground, accept the line as final and complete, and get on with the business of freer trade, freer travel.
The BJP is generally referred to in the press, when I see it, as a Hindu nationalist party, or as the Hindu nationalist party. Just what is the role of religion in the BJP? What sort of significance does it have?
BJP is as Hindu as the Christian Democratic Parties of Europe are Christian. This is the dominant society, but there's nothing particularly Hindu about it, except that India has something like 85% Hindu population. So the general tone is Hindu. There's no doubt about it. India is a democratic society, so it reflects those aspirations.
Well,
nothing beyond that.
So it doesn't necessarily play a role in policy formation?
Not at all. The BJP is not a Hindu party, it's a nationalist party. And this nation includes, of course, Hindus, but everybody else, Muslim, Christian, everybody else. We all have equal rights, equal responsibilities.
Certainly the charge has been made that the BJP is an anti-Muslim party.
True, the charge has been made. There's a reason for that. In 47, when India was partitioned, the RSS, which is a kind of a mother organization for all of us, was opposed to partition. It had as much right to oppose partition as some other people had right to press for partition. So Muslims have an impression from those days that because these people were anti-partition, they are also anti-Muslim. But this is not the true position. Today we have many Muslims in the party. We appointed a Muslim as governor. There's a Muslim in the central government. For long years, we had leader of opposition from the BJP side who was Muslim, Sikandar Bakht. And there are not too many Muslims prominent in the Congress itself. Mm. Somehow, most of the top people, Muslim leadership, migrate to Pakistan. So there, it's a complex issue. Mm-hmm. And there's perfect peace in the country. I think there's been probably no riot, no serious riot in the last few years. Mm.
Let's talk with another caller in Freeport. This is line number 4. Hello?
Yes. Under what was called the British Raj or the English Raj, India suffered years of famine, of course, as did Ireland in that one great period in the 1840s when many people died from this. Today, people of India remember this, these historical tragedies, and are united in that they will refuse to go on to be dominated again, because actually the Western business interests greatly dominate India commercially today, you know. How about that?
Well, do Western business interests greatly dominate India commercially today? I mean, let me ask the guest that question, see if he agrees.
Yes.
Not really, not in a big way.
Well, in the United States, now there's many Indians that are professionals, you know, doctors, engineers, and so on. Doesn't India consider them quite a loss, actually, that they didn't go back to their own country after receiving their education? And sort of selfishly stayed in more advanced countries for a higher standard of living.
Not really. I don't look upon it as brain drain. I look upon it as brain gain. People come here for higher education, take up employment here, many times send back money home. Many of them like to return to India, take up research work there. So I think it's an exchange which is beneficial to both sides, to America and to India.
Yes, there's, in my own area here, there's some very excellent Indian professionals, of course. Mm-hmm.
Good friend referred to the famine in India in 43, and we are all happy that India has not faced a famine after independence.
I see.
It's partly due to the fact that we have a democratic system. I'm sorry to note that China had a very big famine. 3 million, or some people say 30 million people died. People do die of poverty, of undernourishment, but there has been no famine in India in the last 50 years.
Well, you realize that, as I understand it, the U.S. Department of Agriculture aided India with improved crops, you know, and this has prevented any major famines.
Well, I think it's the Mexican seeds which have made a great difference.
Well, thank you for the call. Let's go to another caller here in Champaign. This would be line number 1. Hello.
Hello. The speaker was talking about the BJP. I was just curious if there is any Muslim or any minority in this BJP-led government. I am not sure about that situation. Could you please...
We do have one in the cabinet.
You do have Muslims in the cabinet?
Cabinet, yes. And we have one governor, Muslim governor, BJP man, who was appointed governor, Muhammad Fazal Muhammad.
Oh, which state?
Goa.
Goa, I see. So there are some Muslims in the cabinet, BJP-led?
Yeah.
One,
I see. Okay. One. Yeah, I was just curious about that because I do not hear much about any Muslims participating in the government, in this democratic, so-called democratic government. because Muslim is a large minority there.
True.
So I would expect that some Muslims will be represented in the government.
The problem is like this. In India, we all vote together. There are not too many Muslim MPs in the House, but there are lots of MPs who have got elected because of Muslim support.
I see.
So they also represent Muslim interests. It is not only Muslim MPs who represent Muslim interests, it is all those MPs. And there are Muslims all over the country, in every constituency. So whoever is elected represents his constituency, including the minority.
In this country, we have in the Senate black caucuses and things like that. Is there anything like that in India?
Not yet. Maybe we have it in course of time.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. It is my perception, and you can correct me if this is wrong, that over the last few years there has been some tumult in Indian politics, at least and do again correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that India has had five governments in the last 3 years. Do I have that right? And although now after the elections of last fall, I think there are some people that are expecting now perhaps we'll have a period where things will be a bit more stable. I think BJP has consolidated its control somewhat, but why has it been such a sort of confused time over the last few years?
Complex question. No party was returned with a majority. Some parties got together and picked up somebody and said, we'll support you from outside. And the government went on for a year. After that, these parties supporting from outside, they threw the support. They put up another man. He also didn't suit them, so he withdrew support. The real unfortunate thing happened last year, that's April, when they moved a vote of confidence. And the vote of confidence was passed by one vote, and that also a very dubious vote. And we are thinking of amending the constitution to introduce the German practice that vote of confidence cannot be moved unless the opposition has agreed on somebody else to be the new prime minister. Had this provision been there in our constitution earlier, this vote of no confidence just would not have been moved there because they were not agreed on who would be the new president, new prime minister.
One of the things that I read it comes under the heading of how Indian politics is changing is that it appears that more people, particularly poor people, are becoming involved in politics. They're organizing. There are parties that come to represent their interests and that they're voting. And in fact, Indian politics is becoming more complex rather than less because there are more people who are active and there are more parties. True?
It's okay. This is welcome. This is a functioning democracy. It can be very boisterous democracy, but there it is. I think all things considered, it's good that we have a democracy and a very functioning, very healthy democracy. Everything is transparent.
Well, does that really mean that every government is going to have to be a coalition and that it's going to be continue to be more and more difficult to put coalitions together?
Oh, no. We don't have to think in terms of coalition. In a country of this size, any government is a coalition of interests. Whether it's a coalition of interests or a coalition of parties, it's very secondary. Let us say even the Congress Party. It was not a monolithic party. There were all kind of interests and any number of compromises going into that makeup. So it's better to have an open, frank coalition than some kind of an opportunist alliance coming together. I think Congress made a serious mistake in not inviting other parties to join hands with us. I'll go so far as to say that India is so big, so complex, that even if a party has a majority of its own, it should invite the other parties to join hands, share power and responsibility. A country the size and complexity of India cannot be taken forward by a mere party government.
Do you think that Congress, the Congress Party, made a mistake in turning to Mrs. Gandhi, that is the Rajiv's widow, Mrs. Gandhi, to be the leader of the party? Certainly Congress suffered a very serious defeat last year.
I think they made a very bad mistake.
Was there? It seemed that she, on the one hand, that she came along at a time when Congress was in great disarray, and that she, at one point, she was looked at as being the savior of the party. Now, and then, of course, after the big defeat, she was the goat. She was the scapegoat. Which of those two things was she both, or was it just a mistake to look to her as being a rallying figure?
I think she just is not cut off for public life. She doesn't know India. India doesn't know her. She should not have come forward and assumed this responsibility. And I think congressmen acted very irresponsibly on selecting her as their leader.
Hmm. Was it really a big problem for a lot of Indians, the fact that she was not born in India?
Partly, in the sense that she doesn't speak any Indian language. I'll give you an example. They would just give her an eight-liner speech written out for her, and she would come and read it. Now, this is no way of carrying on politics in a democratic country like India.
Hmm.
On one occasion, she said in the written speech that, "I'm so sorry you have had to wait for long hours in the sun." Actually, it was raining at the time.
but she didn't know what
she
it was.
She didn't know what
was
happening, what she was reading.
Hmm. Well, I'm afraid that we're coming to the point here that we're going to have to stop because we have used our time. My apologies here. I have a caller that I cannot take, but we will have to leave it at that with our thanks to Keval Ram Malkani for being here, former vice president of the BJP and former member of the Indian Senate. Continue to be very involved in politics in India. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
For talking with us. Programming here on WILL made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, and supplements, as well as a full deli, coffee bar, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. If you are not yet a member of the Friends of WILL, this is an important time to consider making your first contribution to AM 580. It costs the station about $100 an hour to bring you comprehensive news and information, and we rely on voluntary contributions from the Friends of WILL to help pay 36%.